All right. Well, thank you everyone for waiting. We're going to get started now. My name is Sarah Causer. I work at IIE. I'm the Outreach and Recruitment Analyst who works on this program. Today, I'm joined by some wonderful colleagues, and I'll let them each introduce themselves, starting with Kaylee, who is one of my colleagues at IIE. Kaylee, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Kaylee Smazniak. I'm a placement advisor at IIE, and I work with the Fulbright Visiting Scholar Program and also the Foreign Student Program.
We're also joined today by David Levin from the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs within the U.S. Department of State. David, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm David Levin with the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs. As Sarah said, with U.S. Department of State. I work on a number of Fulbright programs and also work on the whole issue of diversity. And so this program actually intersects both those interests, Fulbright and diversity. So thank you for tuning in.
Great. Thanks, David. And last but certainly not least, we are joined by a wonderful alumni host of this program, Alan from the University of Baltimore. Alan Lyles, sorry. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Alan Lyles, University of Baltimore. I had a Fulbright SIR scholar for a semester at the University of Baltimore, and I have been a reviewer for two cycles for SIR institutional applications.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, as you might all be aware, today we are having this webinar to go over the general program for the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. Throughout this presentation, we might refer to it as SIR, so just to let you know, that is the short name for this program. If this program is geared towards institutions, it's an institutionally driven application. However, we are aware that online we might have some visiting scholars or interested visiting scholars online. We welcome you. We're glad to have you on here, but please be aware that this program is institutionally driven. So if you do wish to participate and you have a host in mind, please speak to that host and direct them to us at sir@iie.org. We'd be more than happy to work with them to get those applications to move forward. But without further ado, we will move forward. So as I mentioned, today you are attending a webinar about the Scholar in Residence program. We'll be providing an overview of what the SIR program is, including some programmatic insights from the State Department's perspective, as well as trends within the program. Also, we will be including the fact of the number of grant awards and overall insights that we have seen with these programs. We'll then segue into discussing the SIR application components and available tools, and we will wrap it up with some insights from Alan Lyles about his institutional experience with the SIR program. And last but not least, if with whatever time we have left, we will open that for some Q&A. So as you wrote in that you could hear us, that system, you can chat and write and submit questions throughout the duration of this webinar, and we will get to that at the end. And just to let you know, this session is being recorded. We will put it online. So if you need to go back to it, you can find it there. So a brief history of the Fulbright program. It was established in 1946 by a junior senator called J. William Fulbright. This program sends U.S. academics and professionals overseas and brings scholars and professionals from abroad to the U.S. As David was mentioning, it is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it's administered all over the U.S. now by the Institute of International Education. Some things to note is this is a prestigious academic exchange program with the primary purpose is to enhance public diplomacy. One of the goals we always like to say is it is designed to expand and strengthen the relationships between the people of the United States and citizens of the rest of the world. So we like to highlight this just so you are aware as you are crafting those proposals to really, you know, hit home these goals that we have within the Fulbright, larger Fulbright program. On the screen, you can see a little bit of the history of the program. On the left is Dr. Joseph Whitney during his research grant to Burma. It was one of the first grants there. And then on the right, you can actually see a recent grantee from the Fulbright Arctic Initiative a couple of years ago, just to really show the true breadth of this program. So to dive into really what you're here to learn about, the Scholar in Residence program is a wonderful opportunity that actually allows institutions to bring faculty members overseas to their campuses. We're really geared at working with institutions that do not have the opportunity to host scholars or have a strong international presence. That being said, if you do have a strong international presence, we're still more than happy to work with you. This program does help with internationalizing your campus and to develop an exchange course moving forward. The scholars that you would bring primarily teach undergraduate academic courses for either a semester or full academic year, and it also allows you to provide your campus a cross-cultural international perspective in the classroom and across the greater community. The application is made by the interested U.S. institutions, as I mentioned it before, not the visiting scholar. So that is one key note, is this is institutionally driven. While we have over 900 visiting Fulbright visiting scholars on campus around the U.S., what really sets this program apart, which really makes it special for me, is the fact that these scholars are highly integrated into the campus and community life. These scholars are teaching these full course loads, and they should be engaging within the campus culture. Oftentimes, these scholars are viewed as all-stars and tend to be more visible than other Fulbright visiting scholars who might be predominantly stuck within research labs and less exposed. So one of the key driving factors for this is these scholars are really engaged, and we ask that you really look to the fact that you are hosting them and elevating that presence. The application did open in March, and it has a deadline of October 15th, that's the Monday, and as you can see on this webpage, we have our email listed. One special thing that Kaylee will get into later is the fact that we do allow for draft proposals, and that deadline is October 1st. So if you are working, hopefully from now until October, on the proposal, we do encourage you to submit them early. So we're not receiving everyone's on October 1st, but we will provide feedback, and I think that's a key resource that sets this program apart as well. So this next slide on program benefits, I would actually like to ask David Levin to speak to the program benefits that your campus would receive from FIR.
Sure, happy to do that. So as Sarah said, we think this program is unique. Because of the fact that it's an institutional application, and in a sense, you as an institution, you're designing a blueprint. You tell us specifically what kind of scholar you would like, from what country might they come from, what would their field of teaching be, what would you envision for them to do beyond the courses they teach, how can they engage with your class, with your institution across campus, with students, with faculty, with administrators, and how can they engage in the community? So the whole notion of this idea is you designing a blueprint that helps you internationalize, and your scholar is sort of a key component really for that to happen. We want you to talk with us within your proposal about how you see this scholar fitting into your internationalization objectives short-term and long-term, and you look at ways that you can utilize this scholar, as I said, certainly with undergraduate teaching primarily, but also engaging with students who may not be in those courses per se, engaging with faculty, engaging with the outside community, because it really is, it's clearly beneficial to you, having the scholar on campus and engaging them in a variety of ways. But look at it in terms of how can it also be beneficial to the scholar. Coming to the United States, coming to your institution, coming to your part of the country, having an experience that we really talk about benefiting all visiting Fulbrighters, experience America, experience Americans, learn all about us. But I think SIR, Sarah talked about this, because of this integration concept, it makes this program really special. And I think by designing that blueprint I talked about, you're ensuring that you've got great planning in place and that you really take full advantage of the scholar being here and they take full advantage of what you have to offer for them.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David. So moving right along, as David was mentioning about these institutions, we really wanted to talk about the institutions served by SIR. You can see a relatively long list on this page, so I don't want to read it off to you, but really the goal with the SIR program is to engage with institutions that are have either infrequently hosted a visiting scholar on our campus or they serve an underrepresented audience. So as you can see, there's different types of MSIs listed. In the past, we've done a lot of work with HBCUs, HSIs, and tribal colleges, and we hope to continue to do work with these populations as well as grow them to some of the other ones listed. And we will have webinars specifically targeted at these populations. But we also seek to engage with community colleges, small liberal arts, and fully added this year, rural colleges and universities. They've always been encouraged to apply, but we're really trying to hit home that this is an institution population that we really want to work with. If you do not see your institution listed in this, it doesn't mean we don't want you to be involved, but we would ask that you consider partnering with another institution in one of these areas and really submitting a robust application. So this is to give you a quick snapshot of who we're trying to engage with. On this page, you can, as I was mentioning about the types that we have worked with in the past, this is a breakdown of the institutions served by SIR based on those audiences. The largest type of host institution, as you can see, relatively fall within the community colleges as well as the small liberal arts, but it doesn't mean that we don't engage with others. But this is really just to give you a little bit of an idea, and again, I'm going to segue back to David to see if he can highlight some trends that he has seen in addition to these institutional types and where he sees the program moving forward.
Sure, thanks for that. Yeah, I would say that, you know, happily we've seen broader reach in terms of the program and who's participating. We've had sort of black colleges, I think, involved consistently. Hispanic institutions probably less so, although that's clearly increasing. Tribal colleges are difficult at times in terms of getting engaged because they're often rural and they're not as internationally focused, perhaps. But I think we're seeing some increased interest, and we have, we're in the process now of arranging for a scholar from Mexico to come to Tribal College in New Mexico this year. I think we've seen more interest in rural colleges, and that's one of the reasons why we moved from encouraged to apply to actually listing them as a priority. Small liberal arts colleges have always been strong, and I think remain so. So, you know, we're looking at broadening the mix to reach out to Native American serving, Alaskan schools, Alaskan Native institutions, Asian American serving. I think the point is that this program is unique because of the fact that we're prioritizing this effort to reach out to schools, as Sarah said, that are less engaged with international exchange, less engaged with Fulbright, but also, in fact, serving these minority populations. And I think you know, we look forward to an increased number of applications that have come in. We think it's a great opportunity, and we'd like more schools to consider the possibility.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks so much, David. And as we advance with that, I'm actually going to pass the microphone over to Kaylee, who will discuss some of the application components as well as give you a better idea of what goes into this and any insights that she has. So Kaylee, the floor is yours.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah. And can you hear me okay?
Yep, everything's good on this end.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so as Sarah had mentioned, the application is now live on our website. She'll have the links to our website a little bit later. But everything is live, so you can actually go in and maybe while you're tuning in with us right now, maybe click through and see what everything's all about. But you'll see upon starting an application that there's a shorter application form in which you enter text or use drop-downs, followed by a section in which it asks you to upload a number of documents. So first I'll talk about the application form itself. The application all is housed online in a system called Embark, and it really is helpful for institutions to start the application early, just to get a look at what is asked of them and to get a sense of all of the components. It's really helpful to just kind of have it in the back of your mind, especially as you're going into the end of the semester, and kind of see who you might need to catch before people leave for the summer. I would also encourage you to take a look at the Scholar in Residence guidelines to get a more in-depth look at what the components of the application form and the narrative proposal entail, which I'll get into in a moment. So in May, we'll actually be having a webinar and providing a walkthrough of the application. So I'd encourage you to sign up for that, register. And then in early fall, we'll provide two additional last call webinars that will kind of serve as office hours, so applicants can come in and ask any last-minute questions before that proposal draft date comes in October that Sarah had mentioned. So within the application form, you will see you'll be asked to outline institutional information. So contacts on campus for this scholar. I kind of see this as if you were an individual applying for a grant, this would be your biographical section. So you'll be outlining what the institution is if you fall into any of those categories of minority-serving institutions that Sarah mentioned, where you're located. You'll also list a responsible administrative official, so someone who can sign off on any affiliation information. And then, depending on your institution, that administrative official can be the chair of your program or the dean of a school or a provost, even someone in the international office or the finance office. So with that and with a few of these other pieces that I'll mention, we defer to your specific institution because we know that all institutions are they're all made up differently, and we not just one person or one dean would be who an administrative official for each institution. Then we'd also ask that you list a principal contact or faculty associate. So this is the day-to-day contact for the scholar who would make sure that the scholar is taken care of throughout the grant. So this might be in just one a specific department. You'd outline program dates. You probably have seen that we work pretty far in advance with the competition as a whole. So with this competition cycle that's currently open, you're applying to host for the 2019 to 2020 academic year. You'll also outline any financial support and estimates here, which we'll also go over shortly. And then you'll identify if you are naming or asking for us to recruit a scholar for you. And again, I'll be addressing all of this a little bit more in depth in a moment. But if your application is successful, then we'd be using the information in this application form section to provide to our colleagues overseas to assist us. So accuracy is key, you'll be entering the information here and again later in the narrative. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary. It has a limit of 700 characters. And this is a required field, and it gives our reviewers a snapshot of what you're proposing and what your program entails. So you'll use the narrative later to provide specifics, but this summary here is just a really good opportunity to show us what you're asking for, what you want to accomplish. Okay, and then the next slide, the narrative proposal. So there are two parts to the narrative proposal. This is the first, and this is the institutional profile. It is 4 to 5 pages if you are one institution applying, or if it's a joint proposal, then it would be 7 to 8 as you're doubling the institutions. So this section assists us and our reviewers with hearing a little bit more about your institutional characteristics. So the reviewers who are taking a look at all of these applications and reading them through may not know as much about your institution or they might. So this is your chance to highlight what you want us to know and to give them a better idea of what your institution is all about. So things that you include in the institutional profile, they're all listed on the screen here, so size, characteristics, location, all of that. And then we also want to see what kind of current international programs you have on campus, or alternately, what you don't have on campus, what you might need to expand on. So perhaps you've hosted visiting scholars on campus in the past, be it through Fulbright or not. And you can also outline if you have an active study abroad office on campus, if you've hosted faculty, international faculty in the past, such as with the Outreach Lecturing Fund, which we'll talk about later. So just mention that at this point so we can see what's in place or what you plan to have in place. And then lastly, what are your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives? So what are you hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus, and how specifically would hosting a scholar in residence assist and fit to these short and long-term goals? So David, I wanted to open this up to you too and see if you have anything to add about just this first section of the narrative proposal.
I think as we're detailing to you, this is your chance to talk about what your vision is for your institution, what's been working well, what are your ideas short and long term. You're applying for this SIR for a specific reason, and it's either to launch something perhaps that you have not done, or if you've got a program in place, how do you anticipate the scholar in residence helping you take a next step? So as we're talking about these kinds of opportunities, if you've got a program in place already, that doesn't mean that you should not consider SIR, but we'd like to see you then tell us how you're going from step one to step two. Are you expanding on what you've got? So I think it's the whole notion, again, of SIR is internationalization. So this really gives you a chance to think about, what are you doing across campus that will demonstrate to the readers that you're a good institution to host an SIR, and how you thought through how you're going to take full advantage of having that SIR on your campus to further those efforts. And this is unique among Fulbrights. Typically, Fulbrights will come and they'll do their own research, or they'll come and they'll teach based on what they've specifically asked to do. In the case of SIR, we see it really as, in a sense, sort of a service to your institution. The scholars coming here to really do something with you, for you. In this case, it's really to help you internationalize. So it does make this program, I think, unique perhaps among Fulbrights.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much, David. And then the second. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so the second part of the narrative proposal, this is the meat of what the SIR program is really trying to accomplish. So this one is 8 to 9 pages for a single institution applying, or 12 to 13 for joint. So you'll see that it's a little bit longer. And it actually breaks it down by section. So if this seems a little daunting, we don't want it to appear like that at all. We see people break it down actually by these sections and just really show us how the institution is engaged in each of these respects. So within the oversight section, you're addressing who on campus will be responsible for what during the entirety of this visit. So you already have two people identified in the first section of the application in that form part that I had just talked about. So that's the administrative official and also the faculty associate. So perhaps you have someone else that might regularly interact with the scholar. So this provides a nice background of those individuals and what they'll be doing for the Fulbright visiting scholar on campus. So we've seen this oversight section take various forms. There could be a few faculty or staff listed here, or there could be a whole Fulbright Steering Committee that engages staff from different college departments or different backgrounds. So again, this is all really dependent on the specific college or university, and we want to see what thought you have put into the potential scholars program on campus, and that they and you will be set up for success. And the academic program of the scholar. So what will the scholar be teaching? How many courses? What kind of background or specialization will the scholar have or should be required? What qualifications or experience you're looking for to teach these courses? So we often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach while on campus. So we see on average about 2 per semester. Sometimes the scholar might be teaching an already designed course that's already being taught on campus. And then with that kind of thing, they'd be providing international insight into the curriculum on a U.S. campus. And then other times they might be creating an entirely new course. So highlighting this is important to reviewers to understand the amount of preparation that is going to be needed to complete those activities. So next we have outlining plans for other campus activities. So the SIR really interacts with different areas on campus, not necessarily just one department or area. So you might plan for them to conduct a public lecture on their home country or having a guest lecture appearances in other classes. So scholars often don't just work with one department or one faculty associate. They might have a more robust or wide-reaching plan for their stay on campus. Then we have community outreach. So as Sarah and David had mentioned, the scholars are very engaged in not only the campus, but also the larger community. So you might invite community partners to talk about their to talk with the visiting scholar about their home country. And then some might visit high schools in the area or other colleges or universities in the area. Because we understand that for many of the institutions that apply, it is a very unique thing to have a visiting scholar and an international presence on campus. So we want to see how you're planning to maximize on having the scholar and his or her expertise in your area. And professional enrichment. So the application, as we said, is institutionally driven, but we also want to see where there is potential for the scholar's individual growth. So if you plan to include them in faculty meetings or an orientation for new faculty, even attending academic conferences and asking them to join in with different events or activities like this. And then sustainability, so focusing on how you would sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. We'll be hearing from Alan a little bit later about this. And if they've established a new curriculum or developed a new program, how will that course or program continue after the scholars visit? Sometimes this could be in creating an exchange program or a virtual course that will live on past the scholars' presence on campus. So just really think creatively and maximize the use of the scholars' time. And David, did you want to chime in on any insight about some sustainable options that you've seen over the years?
Seen a variety of things. As you said, we've seen student exchanges, faculty exchanges. We've seen online courses where the scholar perhaps continues a course that may have taught on campus but does it online after they return home, or it gets expanded into some other additional class. We've seen connections with local communities. We've seen connections where the scholars, K-12 community at home connects with their K-12 community, while they're on exchange. We've seen connections where a scholar who was in business ended up doing a connection between their home community and host community in terms of local chambers of commerce. We've seen a variety of things where the scholar in the host institution have thought creatively about how do we continue this relationship, how do we expand on what we've done, how do we take what we've got and engage more people in terms of this sharing concept. So there've been a lot of good ideas, you know, through the years, and we're always looking for creative ideas as to how people can see this expansion going on beyond the time that the scholar's with you on campus.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, thank you. Okay, and then the next section is outlining dates. Oh, it's actually still the previous slide. Thank you. So outlining the dates, you've outlined them in the application form, and you also might want to outline them here. So if a scholar could attend an orientation and get acclimated, you might want to just put a little bit more information in this section. And then definitely just make it clear which semester you would like to see a scholar on campus. Just make sure all of that's clear for us. And then lastly, financial support. So in that previous application form section, you had listed financial support available, but then this is also your chance to expand on it. So to show what cost share you are able to provide. So cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively about ways that they can provide this, but it is certainly not required. It will not make or break an application. You won't be disqualified. But in terms of thinking creatively, it could take the form of a salary supplement or in-kind support. So we've seen institutions who've offered meal plans to scholars on campus. They've provided or defrayed the cost of housing, provided transportation, so bus pass or rental car. They've given scholars an opportunity to audit courses, so you can actually put the monetary value of the courses in this section so that we can see what's been thought through. Then, yes, definitely provide the estimates of what these are valued at. And I'll actually open this to David again and see if you had any additional input about this section.
Again, we encourage you to think creatively about ways that you could be assistants. We certainly, if you can do a salary supplement, that's probably the best thing you could do. But we realize that schools are in different situations in terms of your ability to do that. Some of you could, some of you can't. If you said to me in a given year, what is your actual variation look like in terms of actual cost share, salary supplement, we've seen in a given year anywhere from zero to $40,000, let's say. So it really depends on your institution. Mm-hmm. If you're not able to do the actual salary supplement, then as we're talking about, think creatively about, what could you do, whether it's a meal ticket, whether it's some funding perhaps that would enable your scholar to join some of your U.S. colleagues in going to a professional conference. Maybe mm-hmm. it means a membership at a local museum. Maybe it means some other kind of funding for scholarly research. Maybe it means a library facility that becomes available to them. Think creatively about how you could help them. Maybe talk with them once your scholar is confirmed, what kinds of things they might like to see to take advantage of. Think creatively, and you might, in fact, surprise yourself about the kinds of things that you could, in fact, do for your scholar, perhaps at little cost, in fact.
All right, thanks, David. Okay, so now moving on to the scholar. So after the narrative portion, we want to hear more about the scholar that you wish to bring. So this the program allows for two tracks. You can either name a scholar or ask for recruitment of a scholar. As for naming a scholar, maybe a faculty member has met a scholar at an international campus and they want to bring them to your institution for a period of time. So in that case, you can actually name the scholar in your proposal. And if you do name a scholar, just outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant. Because again, this is institutionally driven, so we want to see how a scholar fits into your goals, both long and short term. So in a named scholar situation, we ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation, one of which should speak to a scholar's teaching ability since they're coming to your campus to undertake primarily teaching, and also ensuring that they have the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. All of this is also in our application guidelines. I know this is a lot of information. And then also, if you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections set up already, then that's perfectly fine. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. So you'll be able to choose to different countries within a world region, and these regions are listed on our website. And if you don't see the country of interest on the list, just reach out to us. We can talk with you and walk through if it's possible to engage with a scholar in that country. And then in the proposal, we know it might seem a little tricky if you don't have the named scholar and know exactly who you're working with, that it's hard to think about it in abstract terms. So you'd include information about the type of scholar you'd like for us to recruit. We'd then use these details to reach out to our colleagues abroad and work through a recruitment plan based on discipline or a specialization or a specific skill set that you're requesting. So we ask that you outline the credentials of the scholar and if there's a certain amount of teaching experience that they need or any degree requirements that they'll need to teach on your campus. And again, if you have any questions about any of this, definitely reach out to us at the email address that I believe will be listed again at the end of the presentation. And David, again, if there's any input you want to give about the name or recruitment request.
Sure. I know one of the questions we typically get is, does it make a difference whether I actually request a scholar by name or ask one to be recruited? And mm-hmm. the answer in terms of a preference for us, it doesn't matter at all. I think typically, percentage-wise, we probably see more requests of a scholar specifically by name, and that's fine. But if you don't have specific connections with a given scholar who you're familiar with, or you're not connected to a given country but you'd like to be, we're more than happy to recruit for you, to find a scholar or scholars that we can then share dossiers with you and say, okay, here are some possibilities based on people recruited. Take a look at these dossiers and see if these people think, if you think they meet your interest and your needs.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Okay, so then the last section of the application are these other supplemental materials that are also uploaded. So the letters of support for the institutional application. So these would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do, as opposed to if you had named a scholar having those letters of recommendation. These letters of support are really tied to your institution. So at a minimum, these letters of support should include a letter from the administrative official. There is no maximum. You can seek out letters from different departments across your institution, even neighboring institutions, even the high school in the area, or any community engagement, any clubs in the area that you might want to engage with the SIR. So including a letter of support doesn't necessarily mean that the program is set in stone with that specific partner, but instead it's just showcasing the excitement of the idea of having a scholar in residence on campus and showing that everyone's ready and willing to work with this scholar. So this can also grow once the scholar arrives, so you're not bound to just these letters here. So in this section, we just want to see however many you think you need in order to enhance the strength of your application and show that everyone's ready and willing to jump in. And also the sample syllabi and course outline. So we'd like to see what a course entails and get a sense of what it's all about. So if you're naming a specific scholar, you might already have insight into what they'll be able to teach and then craft the syllabus in that way. And then also it should also show how you can enhance like an already existing outline to show their cultural perspective. And that's the case with both a named and a recruit scholar. Okay, and then on to the review criteria. So once you move forward with your application, you might be curious what the external review community is looking for during review. So we highly recommend that all pieces of the application are working together to strengthen each other and to really give a picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through the hosting a scholar in residence. Again, highlighting the short-term and the long-term goals and saying what they are and how hosting an SIR will contribute to these goals. So think about, is the project feasible within the time period? Think about what types of community outreach and engagement you've included, that you're looking for campus support and not, and everything wouldn't just be benefiting one department. So they should be creating a strong network across the institution and potentially the community. You also want to identify the enrichment opportunities, those professional enrichment opportunities that we mentioned earlier. And then take time to think through the sustainability elements and if there are any other professors sitting in and learning about what they are teaching to help sustain it after the scholar in residence departs. And if you have questions about the review criteria, again, Alan has served as a reviewer for a few cycles, so we'll hear from him in a bit. And he also might be able to tell us how these criteria fit into his own proposed program specifically. Okay. And then back to Sarah.
All right, thanks so much, Kaylee. I'm going to move this along just a little bit to get to Alan, but this timeline is the general timeline that we have had for the past few SIR rounds. You can find it online. As you know, the application is due on October 15th. I mentioned before you can submit proposals up until October 1st. Ideally, the sooner the better. It gives us more time to give you some great feedback, and we're happy if you're not willing to share that with us. If you just want to call and set up a meeting, we can just bounce ideas back and forth. We welcome that. But in short, this timeline, basically after the applications are due on October 15, our staff will conduct a technical review. We may be in touch if there's certain things missing or if we need you to revise something. So it's not, if you happen to miss something, you're not ruled out. We're going to work with you and make sure to remind you that, hey, you missed something, let's get that in. Then we will release the applications to our external committee, which Alan has served on, as Kaylee has mentioned. That meeting happens in December, and they assess the proposals. After the committee is completed, we then reach out to the institutions to notify them of the outcome of that meeting. Then the application will go to ECA, as well as the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, which will review the recommended proposals. And while that is happening, IIE will confirm institutional funding and commitments. From January to about April, we confirm the named scholars or recruit the scholars for you, and we will also provide host campuses with any recruited scholars for consideration. We then send the candidate information to the host institutions, and you will make that final decision based on which scholar would suit your campus's needs. And the last step is from April to June, we issue the grant packets to the scholars once we have all the approvals, and then they will be on your campus. So that's really the short and nitty-gritty part of that timeline. After Alan is done talking, I'm actually going to come back to this and go onto the website. But as you can see, there are a bunch of application resources that we have for you listed. Kaylee mentioned most of them. But at the very end, we will go to that. Our website has some scholar stories as well as my Fulbright. So if you're interested in applying for a scholar Fulbright scholar grant yourself, you can actually register your interest in my Fulbright. But with that, I'm actually going to pass this over to Alan.
Thank you, Sarah. My name again is Alan Lyles. I'm at the University of Baltimore. Since we were just talking about other Fulbright programs, I've had two specialist grants from the Fulbright program, and I would encourage you, if you're thinking about it, to be aware that it is a broad and very specific opportunities depending on your time away and availabilities. coming back to the SIR, the SIR experience that we had at the University of Baltimore matched almost perfectly what I've heard so far. There was assistance throughout. I had examples that were posted on the website that I could look at of what had been successful before. The emphasis when we look at applications is fit holistically with the purposes of the Fulbright program. That is this a proposal that's a good proposal, but it doesn't seem like it's targeted for the aims of this program? Another is dealing with an outlier situation. Is this a situation where the SIR would be, in effect, filling a slot that there needs to be a recruitment for, but it wouldn't enhance or augment what exists already at an institution? So those are the more disqualifying. The more qualifying and those that are strong proposals have the opportunities where there's engagement for the scholars, as you've heard. The engagement that we had, since civic engagement was the primary focus for our scholar, included outreach to local community leadership, to meet with a Hispanic candidate for mayor in our city. Jose prepared a presentation for our campus community, but we got the information out, so making the borders more permeable and encouraging the larger community and not just the community within the university. Using an advisory board, if it fits with the model in your school and the college where the scholar will be, I think is a very strong thing to do because it enhances the perspective of constructing a robust set of experiences for students, for the visiting scholars, and for your own university. What we did was build in an experience in which Jose would give some lectures and co-teach part of a course. He was just with us for a term. And the person who was the course master for that would be the course master for a course that was developed with the scholar in mind in his university that the students would attend the following summer. She led a group of students where course began at our university and continued at Monterey Tech, Jose's university. And we are an urban university, so some of the students have never had that sort of experience. When we were looking for scholars, we weren't just looking for an international experience. We had a strategic plan for our university for outreach to Hispanic students and groups. This helped us activate that, but also the fact that we had a scholar from Mexico meant that the expenses of going and coming would not be prohibitive for having students experience being there at an international setting, that our faculty could begin to form relationships with the faculty there through initially our faculty going there as the course master. Afterwards, that was part of the afterwards, the continuing relationship that we have. I was saying just before the call that I've been talking with Jose about a book that I'm writing on my sabbatical, and we share information about some of the areas in which he was able to look at Baltimore and at Mexico in 1968, and his scholarship is influenced by that, so that continues also. I would say that however the structure of your university, having the support of a provost is quite useful because the provost has such a high perch to see the many possible ways there might be additional fits and opportunities. So when I was discussing this with our provost, there are in the undergraduate programs learning communities in which there that was enriched by having that as a possibility. I'm looking at my notes now. One last thing that is clerical. When Jose came, part of what we had as an offer was a supplemental stipend for our university. In order to obtain that, since we are a state university, a state-supported university, he required a Social Security number. As straightforward a process as that might be, it wasn't. It took at least 6 weeks and maybe longer before that could occur. So if you're planning on offering a stipend, you might think about within your university what can be done to facilitate that so that it would be available when the scholar arrives and the funding then could flow at the same time as the stipends from the Fulbright program. And I think that's it for the moment, unless there are questions.
We currently don't have any questions at the moment, but that's a good segue to encourage those listening. If you have any questions, please submit them as we are getting towards the end of this presentation. But thank you so much, Alan.
You're welcome.
All right, and as we are opening for those questions, I just want to start to wrap this up. And Kaylee did mention one program earlier that is particularly important to me and special. It's the Outreach Lecturing Fund, similar to the Scholar in Residence program. This program is actually looking for the same types of institutions, those community colleges, minority serving institutions, small liberal arts, and we do encourage them to consider hosting if they aren't quite ready to host through Scholar in Residence, or if they are preparing one. This is a nice program to start the process. It's short term, so it's 2 to 6 days, and it'll allow you to get your feet wet as you are preparing for the Scholar in Residence. As I mentioned before, there's over 900 scholars listed online at any given time who are in the United States and eligible to come to your campus. So if you have any questions, you would actually be reaching out to me, Sarah Causer, and the email would be olf@iie.org. Again, it's a great opportunity. We do have webinars on this online, or if you want more details, please feel free to contact me directly. And as we are now segueing to the questions, I just want to let you know that we do have the website, cies.org/SIR, as well as other webinars listed. So Kaylee mentioned this before. We will be having some targeted webinars for community colleges, for minority serving institutions, small liberal arts, and rural, as well as an application walkthrough that she will be leading you actually through that application process. And soon to be published, in the late summer to early fall, we will be having, as the deadline's approaching, we'll be having some webinars that are about last-minute questions, as well as, I think, a final wrap-up. So keep an eye out for those. They'll be very helpful if you just have some burning questions and you don't want to call us directly. But again, we're happy for you to call us directly. And with that, I am going to start with the questions. So the first question is, can SIR co-teach short-term travel seminars during a January term to the region of origin? David, I'm going to send that question to you. Do you have any insight?
Sure. So it sounds like the question is, could the scholar, for example, take the U.S. students back to their home country for a short period of time during a January semester? The answer is yes, that could happen, but we clearly would want to know that's happening in advance. We would need to approve that in advance, because technically the scholar is not supposed to leave the United States and take time away from their grant without prior approval from IIE and from the State Department. So yes, that can happen, but we need to work with you in advance to make sure that that's the process is in place and done correctly, and that, in fact, what the scholar would be doing in the home country with your students falls in line with the objectives of the SIR itself.
Great. Thank you so much. The next question is there a degree level that is expected? Kaylee, did you want to take that question, or do you have any thoughts on that?
So from the application standpoint, if there is an institution applying to host an SIR, if there is any experience that they want the potential scholar to have, they should make sure that that's very clear in the application itself. So if they want someone who has this language ability or certain number of years of teaching experience in a specific field, then that's where we more so see that kind of request within the institutional application. David, did you have anything to add about actual degree level itself, what you've seen?
Sure. I mean, we certainly see a number of people who come in with PhDs or triple degrees, but again, it's not required. It's really up to you as to what you would consider to be sort of a minimum requirement for the scholars to successfully undertake what you want them to do. And also, because the program is open to professionals, not just people from the academic world, it might be that somebody's coming in with considerable experience sort of beyond the academic world, and maybe this trend, a comparison kind of thing. So somebody perhaps that's got 10 or 15 years of you know, on-the-job experience, but in fact may not have a PhD. Well, maybe there's a balance there, and it really depends on what you want that scholar to do and what do you think the qualifications should be for them to successfully carry that out.
Mm-hmm. And we actually had someone submitted a question beforehand, and they asked if an artist or an author could be named or requested. And the answer is yes. With an artist or an author, you would just really need to think through in the institutional application how they would fit into your proposal's goals, especially in terms of teaching. So you'll want to make sure that the scholar that you're requesting or naming has sufficient experience and can meet the goals of what you're laying out and that it's feasible. So if you're not sure about any specific person that you have in mind or scholar that you have in mind, then just reach out to us at that sir@iie.org address that's listed on there right now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Kaylee. We do have a few more questions. The next one is in regards to an institution that's looking to request assistance finding a scholar from a world region. They want to know if they should contact us earlier than the deadline to help the process or by a certain day, or is it only needed in the final submission? And I can start that, and Kaylee or David, please feel free to jump in. But we actually won't go into looking for those scholars until after the review and if your application has moved forward. So if you do wish to call and just kind of bounce ideas off and get a better insight, we're more than happy to work with you on that just to kind of walk you through it. But it is not needed until that final submission. Kaylee or David, do you have something to add?
No, that's definitely right.
I'd say if you have a named scholar in mind, then if you're asking if you should be reaching out to that named scholar and kind of getting their CV and getting their letters of support, then yes, you're definitely welcome to do that at any point. The earlier the better. But yes, otherwise we will be working with both a selected institution and a potential scholar after the deadline has passed.
If I could add our experience in doing that, we had multiple Skype calls with our scholar before he came. The process was to be certain that he would be comfortable and competent at a graduate and undergraduate level of talking with students in English, because we don't have any Spanish courses. And it was perfect that way, but in the course of doing that, we discovered additional opportunities for collaborative work and valuable things that he could do when he was here. So it made it even more desirable that we get that specific scholar as a result of doing that those Skype calls.
Great. Thank you, Alan. That's great insight. The last question that we have as we start to wrap up, and I'm going to segue this one to David, is, does the Fulbright program contribute anything to the stipend for the scholar? David, can you just provide a little bit more insight on that financial piece that is provided with the program?
Sure. So the grant, which would be actually awarded to the scholar, you'd get a number of benefits in that package. One of them is a monthly stipend. that's based on the cost of living in the city where they're going, so the different levels for that, monthly levels. We also would provide the grantee with what we call a settling in allowance. We'd also provide the grantee with a professional enhancement allowance. If the grantee is coming with a family that's going to be with them for 80% of the grant period or longer, we would provide additional funds for dependents. The grantee gets an airline ticket paid for, and again, if they've got dependents coming with them for more than 80% of the grant, we'd also provide funding for one additional family member for an airline ticket, and then we provide accident and health insurance for the grantee. So it's a good package of benefits that will enable the scholar to I think successfully carry out their Fulbright.
Perfect. Thank you so much, David. So with that, that does conclude this. Obviously, if you have questions, please email us. We're more than happy to assist. We're on many different social media platforms, so we are here for you. First off, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day, as well as thank Alan Lyles for joining us. I know he's very busy, but we're always so thrilled to have his involvement in this program, and he's just been such an avid supporter of this. So thank you so much for joining us, Alan.
Thank you.
And with that, we wish you a wonderful Monday afternoon, and we hope to receive applications. Thank you again for joining.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.